supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, today we're talking about autism and families. We'll hear from Temple Grandin and her mother, Eustacia Cutler. We also have Dr. Jim Ball, President and CEO of JB Autism Consulting, on the phone. But first, a clip from the TV show Parenthood. Peter Krause plays the father of a child with autism. Monica Potter, the mother, and they're in session with the psychologist played by Tom Amandus. The parents are struggling around issues of talking to their son about autism.
I said that he was wired differently. I told him we loved him, and I knew that it was a tough situation. What the hell are you supposed to say to him?
Well, you want to be simple, descriptive, upbeat. Emphasize some positive aspects of having Asperger's.
Yeah, the positive aspects of Asperger's. I'm sorry, those weren't occurring to me in the moment. I mean, is this seriously your advice, to be upbeat?
It's a suggestion that I believe helps, yes.
Well, I'm sorry, it was an emotional situation. I was doing the best I could. I mean, Christina was crying, it was late, I just finished shouting that he had Asperger's. I didn't know he was there.
Christina, you cried.
Yeah, I cried.
Wait a minute, are you really getting judgmental because she was feeling emotional?
It's okay, honey, I just want to hear what
you're saying. No, of course not. It's completely natural. I promise you, I'm not being judgmental. I'm looking for something that I think will help. I know it's
here. Are you saying that I shouldn't have cried? I mean, I didn't really plan on...
Crying implies that having Asperger's is something to mourn, right? We want to be sending a message that Max is like everyone else. He has his strengths. He has his challenges. Asperger's is a part of that.
Okay, great. All right, well, she cried. I called it a disability. We blew it. I think that's clear. So what do we do now?
So let's talk with Jim Ball, also executive chair of the National Board of Directors of the Autism Society. So, Jim, what do we do now?
I thought that the person playing the psychologist was right on target. You know, I think a lot of times the kids will investigate if they're different, and when they actually articulate it is the time that we really need to address it. Some of our individuals never address it because they don't think that they're any different, so we don't normally just go to them and talk to them about having a disability. But I think the bigger thing, or the bigger picture, is really looking at helping them to self-advocate for them, you know, for themselves, ways to teach them to know when to disclose and when not to disclose.
Well, that's for down the pike with kids, and that's also for kids at the higher end of the autism spectrum.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I disagree with what Tom Amandus did on the show. You know, he's got his sense of what these kids need, and God knows I'm not going to challenge either one of you, but you do cry. You do experience it as a disability. It takes a while as a parent to see what the upside is. You know, the father here, you know, I get that. And the tears in the mother, I get that too. And, you know, that's got to be universal also.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, though, for the show, it was the two of them were arguing about it and their son happened to hear it.
Right.
Just like you would, like if a neurotypical kid was having an issue and you were discussing it and the kid happened to hear it.
Right.
So they're going to see some of the frustration. They're going to see some of the anger. They're going to see some of their, you know, their mother crying over it and their father being, you know, trying to fix it because, you know, men are fixers and, you know,
right.
He can't fix it. So he gets frustrated. So I think the way it was disclosed there is not always the way our kids go about trying to find out about how they're different.
Right.
So I think in that particular case, you need to just be positive, explain it, and say, you know, exactly what the facts are, because our kids are very factual.
The problem with these damn kids, Jim, is somehow, you know, if we're not being honest with them, somehow they know it, and that's really annoying. So, I think, you know, it's, I've got a Sufi saying on my desk that says, when the heart weeps for what it's lost, the soul rejoices for what it's found. And, you know, there's got to be room and time for mourning first in the family before they can, you know, look at this kid and see what an amazing thing we have in our lives.
And that's very true. That's very true. And I think that's why, you know, not knowing why autism occurs really is a struggle for our families, because I don't think they actually ever get to that point of acceptance and understanding, because they're still struggling to find out why.
Yeah. And as though, you know, when we find out why about most anything, that we'll be able to fix it.
Yes.
And why is just going to tell you why, ideally. So I want to come back to your webpage and your philosophies all over there, where you say it's all about people and relationships. And of course, that's true. It's true. It's true for all of us. But tell me about how we do that with a child with a great big screaming label of autism.
And I think that's the whole crux of taking it from an individual perspective,
yeah,
is the fact that we do have this big gaping thing over their head, or cloud, or whatever you want to call it, that says autism, and people really never get to know the individual. And that's what I try to do in the kids and the adults that I work with, is get to know them at their level, get to know what makes them tick, get to know what they need, and help them to celebrate their successes and their abilities, and then also try to work with their challenges.
Well, I've got to tell you, my daughter Debbie, and I know a lot of parents of children on the spectrum. You know, she was wonderful when Sam was little, and did all the right thing and helped nurture his inside, his gifts. But when it came to getting services, she had to maximize the problem and the labels. And that's just a horrible position for parents.
Yeah, and the sad part is that in a vast majority of the cases, depending on where you live in the country, a lot of that starts out adversarial with the people that are going to be providing the services, because families have to fight for it.
Right. It's just an awful situation.
Mm-hmm.
So let's come back to the beginning. And you said, if they're asking questions, it's time to chat. Well, the same thing goes with sex ed for kids, too. And you know, there's similarities. You know, it's how do we begin having a very uncomfortable conversation? So you said to avoid technical terms and be specific. So play that out. What's that look like and sound like?
And it, what's so interesting is, just a week and a half ago, a family that I've been working with for a long time in West Virginia, the son is now, I believe he's 8, and he started to challenge it. And the family, we had conversations, and what they did is had books available at his age range so he could read, because a lot of our kids love to read. And then just showing the successes of autism, like people like Temple, you know, Grandin, and that kids with autism, especially Asperger's and the kids that are more able, these guys and girls can go on and get married and have kids, and you know, life's not going to be, you know, sheltered for them. They have every opportunity. It's just us opening up the world to them, and they're just going to see it a little differently. But don't we all see the world a little differently?
Yeah, I hope I don't get the author wrong. Robert Klein, I think, up in the Boston area, wrote a book, and the title of the book was "You Will Dream New Dreams."
Mm-hmm.
And the task for all parents, Jim, is, you know, to raise the children you have and not the child you want.
Right.
I mean, and especially so on the autism spectrum. Hey, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Dr. Jim Ball. He's president and CEO of JB Autism Consulting. And our number, by the way, if you want to join the conversation, is 888 477 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Please, please call early in the show, because we're going to be backed up, especially on this topic. So, Jim, tell me more about what we say and when we say it, and how first we parents turn our minds around so that we can see the gifts.
I think you just need to, again, you know, parents know their kids the best. They know their challenges the best because they live with them every day, but they also know their gifts. And, you know, with a lot of the families I work with, especially at the younger ages, it's about jotting down those gifts. Write them down, you know, make a list of them, so that when that time comes, you can talk about those things. And that time may never come, because a lot of our individuals, like I talked about earlier, don't really find themselves that different. And in their differences, they like who they are. And that's one of the things I appreciate most about the individuals that I have the great opportunity to work with is, you know, they are so comfortable with themselves. My biggest, obstacle in working with my individuals is when should they disclose and when shouldn't they, and really looking at the self-advocacy part. And Temple talks a lot about that, especially in her movie, you know, Temple Grandin. They talk about, you know, her being taken advantage of early in her life, and she talks about it, you know, because she did self-disclose a lot, and that taught her that maybe I shouldn't, you know, talk to people as much about it.
So that's what Temple said. Tell me what Jim Ball says about self-disclosure here, and what and when and how, because we're talking about a population, majority of whom doesn't have great social skills.
Right. Yeah, and to me, you know, again, and this isn't a cop-out, but this is a reality, every kid is very, very different. So it's going to look different in every kid. And my biggest resource for families and individuals especially is a book that I think is just the quintessential book on self-disclosure and self-advocacy. And that was written by Stephen Shore, an individual on the spectrum who's a professor at Adelphi University on Long Island. And his book really, really talks about how to do those things and when to. And there's another thing. The Autism Society of America has a national conference every year. This year it'll be in Denver, I believe, July 7th through the 12th. And Temple will be keynoting again this year for us. And what I love about our conference is every Wednesday, which is a pre-conference day, we have a self-advocacy day. So we invite individuals who are, you know, leaders in their field, and they come in and they do a day with individuals on the spectrum on life, you know, life on the spectrum.
All right, let me now be an advocate for parents who are listening to the show, who want to know more about this, who aren't going to go to Denver, and maybe not by Stephen Shore's book. So let me press you here, if I may, Jim, with all due respect, and I mean that. But right. I want to press you for the parents listening. So say I'm a parent. What do I tell my children? How can I teach my child to self-advocate? And where and when, based on what? Give me some ideas.
Well, I think you've got to know your child. You've got to know what they share and what they don't share in general. Do they say too much? Do they have impulse control problems, which means whatever pops in their head pops out of their mouth? Talking about factually, you know, things that we do talk about, things that we don't talk about, and making literal lists of what these look like, and use visuals to show them that, you know, these things we just don't talk about unless it's family. These things are things that we can talk about in front of our friends. These are, you know, even differentiating between what an acquaintance is, what a friend is, you know, what a family member is, because a lot of times those lines are blurred for our individual. So you've got to know the particular individual. You've got to make it very factual. You've got to sit down with lists and write things out so there's visuals for the individual. And I think those are the best strategies. But again, it's going to come down to how that individual presents within their own autism.
And yeah, so you can get a sense of that within the family.
Mm-hmm,
and when friends come over, when they're out socially. That's very, very helpful. I want to talk a little bit before we have to take our break. I want to talk a little bit about that couple, that or any couple when they have a child with autism. You know, people deal with it very differently. There's, of course, male energy and female energy, and men have their own issues with autism. My dear friend and colleague here in Philadelphia, Robert Nassif, has written extensively about fathers and autism. So, what's the divorce rate, and what can be done to minimize marital conflict here?
I'd say, and I know Robert very well, and Robert and I have actually done talks together for fathers, and he actually is a person that comes to our national conference every year to talk with our families. So he's a great resource for the area. And going back to your question, I mean, I think it's for me especially. When I'm working with a new family, it's about the couple more so than it is about the kid. The child's the easier part, but it's maintaining the couple in communication. And these are going to be all those cliches, but they are so real. In communicating, in sharing, you know, in telling, you know, exactly what it is you want to see happen for your child, what your dreams are, what your goals are. And I work with my families really hard on just going, you know, 1 or 2 months out, what is our goal here, and what's mom going to do, what's dad going to do, so everybody sees everybody's role, you know, in that plan. And I'm a big advocate of planning for the family, and that keeps both parents involved, because a lot of times what we see is, you know, our mothers take over the role of doing everything. Our fathers tend to just, you know, I'm working, I'm making the money, I'm, you know, bringing it home, I'm doing my job, when mom really needs that emotional support, you know, especially with a child that has maybe more meltdowns than another.
You know, we had a show years ago, and the show was around caring for aging parents.
And
my guest on the show said something really interesting that I'd never thought about. So the issue we were talking about is you know, these adult siblings, and people get mad at each other because one does more, just as you described. And he said the way to get through that is not to make people different, but to understand what each person is able to bring to this and what they're not and what they're, you know, so everybody brings something different to
right.
this situation. We have, like the kids, we have to know what you bring, what gifts you bring to this, and you know, with both parents, and that's where we begin a dialogue rather than trying to change each other, which you know inevitably goes down the toilet.
Right. And I think it's really important to define those roles.
Exactly. We've got to take a short break. We're going to be back in just 1 minute, Jim. And when we do, we're going to be talking with Temple Grandin and later on her mother, Eustacia Cutler. Jim Ball is president and CEO of JB Autism Consulting. He's also executive chair of the National Board of Directors of the Autism Society. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. What is the impact of autism on your family, on your lives, on your marriage? 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Proudly supporting WHYY is Camp Hill Special School, an accredited Waldorf school with day and boarding options dedicated to redefining what is possible for children with special needs. Students contribute to the community as a whole by taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating in student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Campus tours on April 29th and May 20th at 9 a.m., and an open house is on May 16th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at Devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about autism and its impact on the family. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Ball, who's president and CEO of JB Autism Consulting, and we'll be talking with him again in just a few minutes. But for now, as promised, a few weeks ago, we spoke with Temple Grandin, and we all know the work she has done to help us understand autism and the amazing work she's done with animals also. When I spoke to her, I asked her about her childhood and autism today.
One of the big problems you got with autism is now they've changed the specifications. 2013, it's turned into such a huge spectrum. You're going all the way from people that work at Silicon Valley and Einstein and some gifted kids to somebody who cannot dress themselves. It's made the spectrum ridiculously broad, you know, or something like ADHD or dyslexia. That's a much more narrow spectrum.
How do you feel about yourself vis-a-vis that label? Do you consider yourself autistic?
Well, I had all the full symptoms of autism when I was a child. One thing I get worried about, especially with the kids on the higher end of the spectrum, is they get so hung up on their autism. You see, when I was a teenager, I was hung up on riding my horse and electronics lab, and this is why it's so important for these kids to get involved with peers with a specialized interest that they can share together.
I want to go all the way back, and I wonder, how did you learn social skills when you were younger?
Old-fashioned 1950s parenting, and it was taught to every child in the neighborhood. You know, kids were just brought up in a much more rigid way. In all around the whole neighborhood would make corrections if I made social mistakes. You know, if I ate my mashed potatoes with my finger, they'd say, use the fork. If I pushed in line, they'd say, you have to wait your turn. That was taught to every child in the 50s. This is part of the problem. We're not teaching social skills the same way that they were taught years ago.
You had to learn when kids got bored with or annoyed with your repeating things over and over.
Well, and I had to make some rules, too. I only tell that story twice. When I was in college, I had a rule, no more than two questions per class period.
Do you still struggle with that of
Well, not so much now because I've learned, you know, how to do it. But and my best friends have shared interests. You know, activities that they can share and enjoy with other kids with shared interests. Also, those were the only places for me where there was no teasing. Everywhere else I went, there was teasing.
Do you think the teasing had a big impact on you?
Well, in high school, it was horrible. But the thing that saved me was having showing horses in 4-H, working in the horse barn. We had a model rocket club and an electronics lab, and those were places where there was no teasing. Those things were absolutely essential to my success.
Do you have a sense of what other people are experiencing when you're talking to someone one-on-one? Do you get a sense of...
Well, that's sort of such an abstract question I can't even answer.
Well, I mean, do you get a... Well, you talked about knowing when people are bored or irritated.
Yes.
So, do you still have to consciously work on knowing
Everything is done consciously. Everything is done consciously.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, you have to do it consciously.
Yeah.
It's like being in a foreign country. You have to teach social skills as if the person's going to be in a foreign country.
Well, Temple, I really appreciate your time and your knowledge here, what you've shared with us. Thank you so much.
All right, but it's been very, very good to talk to you.
You take care.
Okay, yeah, bye.
That was Temple Grandin, and I had the great pleasure of speaking with her a few weeks ago. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let me say that a little bit more clearly. That's 888-477-9499. We're still here with Dr. Jim Ball, who's executive chair of the National Board of Directors of the Autism Society. You know, Jim, we touched briefly on the issue of shaming and how it didn't have that much of an impact on her because she had areas where that were shame-free in her life. But now I wonder what the impact of shaming is on these kids.
We really don't know that impact because we don't know how they internalize it a lot of the times. Some of our kids don't even know when they're being bullied. But they do have meltdowns based on triggers that other kids might, know. So in a class, they may do something to trigger a behavior, and the kid doesn't really understand it. And why, that's why a lot of times our kids are very big rule followers, too.
Yeah.
And they will point out the injustices and the rules, but they tend to do it for everything. So they don't know when there's a time to break a rule and a time not to. So it's really difficult with a lot of them on exactly what they internalize and how they manifest it. So how it comes out in their behavior.
Yeah, my grandson, Sam, really never understood aggression. He didn't have a receptor site in his brain for aggression, for meanness. And,
right.
As he's grown and developed, I don't even know if anybody would diagnose him on the spectrum anymore. But he still does not have that receptor site in his brain for meanness. Even when I spoke to him, I wrote a book called The Wisdom of Sam after he was much older. And I said to him, God, he had to be 10 years old. I said, Sam, do you feel you're different than the other kids? And he said, yeah, I do. And I said, how are you different? And he thought about it. We're sitting on steps. And I said, how are you different? And he thought about it for a long time, and he said, Pop, I'm more kind.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's Sam. And I think that's, it's not just Sam. The blessing is a lot of these kids don't have that receptor site.
But there's a young man I work with who's also, Scott Badish is our president and CEO of the Autism Society, and we have a wonderful contact center for families there. So if they're looking for resources, it's 1-800-3-AUTISM or theautismsociety.com, and they can get to our contact center. There's tons of resources there, but his son, who is a junior at Marshall University, he came home once and Scott was struggling with, okay, do I call you autistic? Do I call you a person on the spectrum? Do I call you a person living with autism? And he asked his son, Evan, he goes, so what should I do? What should I say? And he sort of looked at him and he goes, Dad, I live with you. And I think that was so classic.
That's great. Let's go to the phones here. We've got Fran on the line. Hi, Fran.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a great show. I have a 17-year-old in 11th grade with, I guess, PDNOS/Asperger's. We've combated a lot of the social skills issues in terms of knowing what to say when. But what we're worried about now as he is getting ready for college is executive functions. Staying, organized. I saw one of his schoolmates in a store, and the kid pulled out a wallet and was, making a transaction in a store. And I just thought to myself, I don't know if my kid could do that or would know what to do. And I'm just wondering, are there programs for, teenagers to get them ready for college in terms of or life, actually? Even if they're not going to college,
Boy,
or executive functions.
Boy, Fran, I think you just asked Jim Ball a question that is right in the middle of a sweet spot for him. I have a feeling he's going to be thrilled with this question. I'm going to ask you to take it off the air. Okay, Jim, run with this.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, it's great that she recognizes that, because a lot of times parents will send their kids to college without having those particular skills. The first thing that I would suggest is that she works within what she's doing right now in her school setting to do IEP goals and objectives that will address those areas. So to teach them how to be more functional, teach them how to have a good organizational system. And this should have been being done for years, because the one thing, you know, our kids struggle with are those organizational systems. And hopefully they can be able to put those things into place, but also, you know, teach him how to, you know, manage a checkbook, or how to use an ATM card, or how to get his lunch, you know, in the cafeteria. And those things might be things that they've already done, but they need to focus on that, especially if he's going to go away. For kids that aren't ready at first, the community college option is a wonderful option, because you can see while they're there and they're doing the academic work where they may be falling apart in the executive functioning. So there's still things that you can teach during that time before they then go to a four-year college and, you know, start to get that social piece.
Is there a place, a book, a resource, a group that she could go to?
Well, the first thing is there's a Greater Philadelphia Autism Society affiliate of ours. We have 106 affiliates throughout the country, and the Greater Philadelphia Autism Society is a wonderful resource.
Perhaps wherever she goes, she should go with her son?
Those, I would just call them, and they can give her the resources in her area, because the Autism Society, you know, what we do is we have those affiliates that are out in, you know, the geographical areas where the kids and the parents live. So the resources in Philly might be different than Pittsburgh, and might be different than Wheeling, West Virginia, or Dallas, Texas. And also, you know, life in those areas are very different too, just based on location. So if she reaches out, the Greater Philadelphia Autism Society affiliate would be able to give her resources in that area to help in those particular areas that she's, you know, feeling that he has deficits in.
That's great. Fran, I sure hope that was helpful. And let's, I promised we would hear my interview with Eustacia Cutler, but let's wait until after our break. We're talking with Jim Ball, President and CEO of JB Autism Consulting. We've got to take a very short break. And when we come back, we'll play my interview with Eustacia Cutler and take more of your calls. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417, or online at philafound.org.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman for the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. With the opening of our new seven-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, Wistar Science is able to accelerate its efforts to create new cancer therapies. Our discoveries can help understand why cancers spread and are the basis for new Wistar drugs that target and attack the cause of advanced prostate cancer. Learn more about Wistar Science at wistar.org. Wistar Science saves lives.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about autism in the family. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Ball. But first, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Temple Grandin, and then I spoke with her mother, Eustacia Cutler. She had an awful lot to say about raising a child in the 50s and everything she has learned about autism and how to best be a parent. Let's listen to that interview with Eustacia.
A baby needs a mother to know she's a baby, but a mother needs a baby to know she's a mother.
Did you experience that?
Yes, I did. I was very young. I was 20 when Temple was born, and I didn't know what to make of this baby who didn't want me, who, what I could see, didn't want me. And you have to remember that Temple was born in 1947, which was right after World War II, and no babies were born during World War II. So I'd never even held a baby. So here was this baby who didn't want to smile at me and didn't want to play peekaboo, who didn't acknowledge my presence and didn't want to be touched. Now, of course, my young reaction was, oh, well, then I won't touch you, which, of course, was wrong, which I've said to Temple many times. I said, if you'd been the third child instead of the first child, I have four children in all, I would have just gathered you up along with the toys and the puppy and everything else that was going on in the house, and she would have been drawn in to that household. There's this gap in there, and what I find in parents, and you must run into it too, is they feel terribly guilty. They feel in some way they're bad parents. They cannot get their own footing.
Well, even I find parents whose children have genetic influences on their depression or anxiety disorder, even knowing there's genetics in there, they feel guilty about their genes. So it doesn't take much for a parent to feel guilty.
No, it doesn't. But I keep trying to reinforce the identity of the parents themselves.
When we spoke with Temple, she talked a lot about the 50s and how important it was for her to grow up in the 50s, the structure, the sense of right and wrong back then. What was it like for you, Teresa?
Well, I think, yes, and I'm glad to hear that she's picking up on that, because I think some of that she's realized as she's heard me talk. There were many faults in the 50s, but there was a community approach to life. We all looked at it the same way. And Temple was able to absorb the fact that if she wanted to play with the other children, she'd have to play by their rules. Otherwise, they wouldn't let her in the game. And what it did was, then after they got to Nilla, found that she was fun to have and she had some good ideas that they wanted. So the exchange began to take place.
I want to talk about you, Eustacia, and your personality, because back then, children on the spectrum or children who were different, many were encouraged to be institutionalized.
Well, I was lucky. Several things worked in my favor. One, Children's Hospital in Boston did not recommend institutionalizing. They recommended speech lessons. Now, it meant that by two, Temple was getting instruction on speech. She two things had to happen. For one, I think she wanted to talk. And as you've just discovered, she hasn't stopped talking ever since. But she also, again, it was like joining the children in the game. She wanted to join. And that meant that Mrs. Reynolds, who was the teacher then, could teach her how to sit and wait her turn. There were other children in the class, and their concerns also mattered.
I want to shift gears for a minute. I wonder about her siblings. It's like we in the field are finally discovering that kids on the spectrum actually have siblings, and they count too.
I couldn't agree more. I've talked about this. And it's been, when people have asked me, what would I do now differently from what I did then, I'd do better by the siblings. You see, there were three more children after Temple, and they're good children, and they're trying to be obedient, but nobody's praising them. And they're having to play the role of helper. Well, that's not a fair role. They're children too, growing up.
Well,
what we are looking for ourselves, but for our children, first of all, I remember feeling for Temple, it isn't that she be changed or cured. I'm very wary of those words. I wanted her to be fulfilled, and fulfilled as she would like to be fulfilled.
I think you make a great point. Thank you, Eustacia.
Well, thank you.
That was Eustacia Cutler, mother of Temple Grandin. And I've got to tell you, she's doing some remarkable work with autism, and you can find a link on our website. Siblings are an issue that hardly ever get talked about here, Jim.
I know.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing I've found, though, in you know, I do a lot of work with disability and research in it, but often siblings and children, they get lost, and that's the downside. The upside is that these kids tend to be more compassionate than others and tend to get more involved in the world around them. You know, pursuing social justice, they're more likely. Mm-hmm. And that of course is the upside, but you know, kids do need attention.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to the phones here. We've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You opened the program with Dr. Ball speaking about self-disclosure or disclosure to your kids about autism. We have a 3.5-year-old who experiences significant challenges in speech and global development. And as parents, we just want him to be comfortable with himself and to be confident in his surroundings. But sometimes those delays actually impair that. So to meet other children like him, we've included him in charitable events and programs related to his condition. And my question is really in regards to this. Is involvement in the autism community at that young of an age a good way to immerse our children in that self-disclosure process? Or do you find that when children are introduced that early to, say, Autism Society or some sort of charitable organization for their condition, that it may have adverse effects, like they meet more severe people with more severe conditions and then maybe are more reluctant to
that's
speak for themselves in the future?
Great question, Laura. What say you, Jim?
I think it can go both ways. I think you still need to immerse them with the charitable organizations, because that's the way mom and dad can get really good information. But for a child that age, my advice would be to do exactly what Eustacia did with Temple, and I talk about it a lot when I talk about it, and also in my book, which is Early Intervention in Autism, Real Life Questions, Real Life Answers. It actually tackles this as part of one of the chapters, in really helping the families to immerse the kid around as many neurotypical kids as they can also, because you want them to gain the really good language skills and also understand the social skills and also be part of, you know, the society that they're going to live in, because that's where they're going to go to school. These are the kids they're going to be immersed with. And that, to me, is a bigger piece in their inclusionary opportunities is with the neurotypical kids, because, again, like Temple talked, and I think when Eustacia was talking about it, the 50s parenting is, you know, you go outside, you play, and when the lights go on, you come back home, you eat, and when you eat with a fork, you don't eat with your finger. You know, there's certain things, and everybody, you know, in the neighborhood parents the same way, so you need to do that, and they don't accept things that are inaccurate or just, oh, because he's, you know, because of his disability, you know, it's all right if he does that. Well, if you talk to Eustacia, she would say definitely not, you know, and I am of the, you know, the same ilk that you need to really have them around as many neurotypical kids as you can, and for the family itself, you know, get involved with the charitable organization so that you can get the resources that you need.
I think that's just a wonderful answer, and I appreciate it. I hope it's helpful, Laura. But the other thing I would add, now, bear in mind, you know, I'm just coming at this as you know, a garden variety shrink, but Eustacia Cutler said, you know, her approach to raising Temple, there was a quality in there of what I call faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that my kid's going to be okay. There's something in there that I trust, that I have faith in. And, you know, I believe deeply, Jim, that parenting is that balance between fear and faith. And if we raise any of our children, whether they're on the spectrum or not, but if we let our own anxiety inform us about child rearing, everybody's going to suffer.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah. We've got to, parents have to take care of themselves and learn about faith. You know, I had a patient years ago, Jim, who said that she felt like she was a diamond inside a malignant tumor. And she didn't know who was going to win and, with, you know, whether she would survive. And, you know, we go after the tumor. But you know, we learned from Eustacia. We learned from Temple and so many other parents. You nurture the diamond. That's how you have your life, is you nurture the diamond. Let's see if we can get a couple more calls in. We've got, let me see, Grace on the line. Hi, Grace.
How are you? Can you hear me okay?
I hear you well, thanks.
Wonderful. We all do. We all, I was just going to say, I have the most amazing daughter. She's 20. She has Asperger's. We did early intervention, IEP. She went to a performing arts high school, musically gifted, you know, the amazing autistic memory. And so now she's a French major and she's studying abroad in Montreal. And so I'm going to cry. And for as amazing and as wonderful as she is, she does not understand chit-chat and does not understand how to make a friend.
Doesn't
get that.
Does she want to?
Yes. She often, you know, she posts on, we keep in touch with Facebook while she's at college in Canada and comments on how lonely she is, but she's just accomplished so many other things beyond what you would expect a 20-year-old to do on her own. I'm so proud of her, but she just doesn't have a friend, a real friend, someone close.
That is heartbreaking. I've got to hear from you, Jim, because that's, you know, the story Grace tells about her daughter is heartbreaking, and you can multiply that how many thousands, if not millions, of times.
And Dan, I got to applaud you because I would have asked that same question, like, does she? Because some of the individuals that I work with are very articulate, and they're like, you know what, when I need people, I'm go around them, and when I don't, I go by myself, you know, and I don't really need that that socialness. So they understand themselves very well. But the fact that the mother, Grace, had said that, you know, her daughter does want friends, there's, you know, two ways that I would approach it. You know, one would be to try to contact the actual university, because, and I'm not familiar, I'm more familiar obviously with the United States system, but not necessarily the Canadian system, but to look at their special services area of the college and see if they can't assist in getting her into groups of people with similar interests. Because obviously if she's at a performing arts, you know, school and she's studying French, there are probably groups that she can get into, because as Temple would explain it, and I think she articulated it in your talk with her earlier, was what made her have those opportunities were those common interests. So for her, it was horseback riding. And it sounds like this girl has some of those common interests, and it's just finding those people who have similar common interests, because then she brings something to that relationship, and those people are looking for that. So that's where those are the two things that I would suggest for her.
That's great. Thanks so much. We've got a caller who wants to know about extended family. What can they do to support their family members who have a child with autism? It's a great question, because it affects everybody.
Absolutely. And as I always talk about it, it's a family disability. So it's siblings, it's grandparents, it's uncles, it's aunts. And I think for that, it's about educating them, because we have a lot of information, especially at our website, you know, www.autismsociety.com, on grandparents, especially. So helping them to understand that, you know, the kid's just not being bad. You just don't have to do, you know, A, B, and C, and everything's going to be fine. It really articulates to them, you know, what the disability looks like, why these kids do what they do. And it's about educating everybody in the family about the disability, so that they know when that meltdown occurs, it's not good to feed into it. Or when that meltdown occurs, everybody's ignoring it and not to talk to the child. So I think in those cases, for the families, it's really about the education, and if they go to our website, they'll find some really good resources for it.
That's great. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and you know, there's a big issue we haven't touched on yet, and that's the older kids. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones who are 18 years old and you know, they're going to flood, and they're starting to flood now, the meager resources we have available.
Right now, just so your audience knows, and for your, you know, for your information too, the Autism Society actually is in the middle of its 5-year strategic planning process, and we're looking strictly at adult services, because we know that glut of kids is going to be coming out in the next 2 to 3 years, and that our adult services system is not ready for it. Or equipped to handle a lot of these individuals. And not so much the individuals that are more challenged on the spectrum, but also for those individuals, you know, like our last caller, you know, talked about her daughter who went on to college, because even our more able kids, a lot of them are either underemployed or not employed at all, and should be. So it's really, you know, looking at how do we, and not creating new laws, but the Autism Society is really looking at how do we take existing laws and help those laws to affect our individuals, you know, as they grow older, and also accessing, you know, the under 21 system, you know, where we already have laws in place, and helping schools and transition services to really affect change in our individuals, especially as they get older.
Well, and we should add before we close, there's lots and lots and lots of good news out there. And you know, our own Phillies here, and you know, people are thinking there's not a whole lot of good news about the Phillies, but they've got great programs for, you know, for autism awareness for kids, and they employ a lot of kids on the spectrum. So there's lots and lots of good news out there, and you know, you can get access to that also.
Well, they actually 2 years ago won the Autism Society of America's award for Employer of the Year. Yeah. The Phillies. And
yeah,
the reason
I think they're terrific. We are just about running out of time, Jim, and I'm sorry to cut you off in mid-sentence, but I do want to thank you so much for joining us. Jim Balls, president and CEO of JB Autism Consulting. We've got a ton of research on our webpage, so please check it out. And thanks to Roseanne Vanilla of familyaffairs.com and the Durand Program for helping us arrange our interviews with Temple Grandin and Eustacia Cutler. And of course, thanks to Eustacia and Temple for taking the time to talk with us. You can follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. And my webpage is drdangottlieb.com. The engineer has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Pers Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Zakiya Gibbons is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family, and we're thankful for it. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.